This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, it's been almost 50 years since Dr. Martin Luther King broke with a Democratic president over the Vietnam War. But talking peace is still politically risky. And whether you want to reform the U.S. prison system or abolish it altogether, you'll want to be in Washington on August 19th for the Millions for Prisoners Human Rights March.
But first, lots of folks give lip service to the idea of community control of the police, but some people in Washington, D.C. are doing something about it. Netfa Freeman is with Pan-African Community Action in the nation's capital. Freeman's organization supports a community control of the police plan similar to the system envisioned by the late Black Panther Party leader Huey P. Newton. However, with all the political energy and outrage directed at President Donald Trump or the Russians, there doesn't seem to be as much focus as before on the issue of police terror in Black America.
Yeah, I would definitely say that's my impression. Even locally, we've had some killings by some police that are not being addressed anymore, like Terrence Sterling, and has been still not no justice for Terrence Sterling. And then, like you said, on the national level, just the assaults by police in general have seemed to not be at the forefront of the discussions of the movement for Black Lives or people, all kind of organizations, I'd say, involved in that movement. And it's very interesting, given the fact that Trump has such a broad-based support by the police unions and has called for certain things that would support more impunity for police. And I think it's a dangerous time to back off on that sort of thing. But what also seems to be a rise, at least locally in Washington, D.C., where I am, is a shift in concern or addressing what a lot of people call black-on-black crime. And so the local movements here and the alliance of different organizations that you could say are part of the localized manifestation of Movement for Black Lives or the Black Lives Matter movement have focused on supporting an act, the NEAR Act, the Neighborhood Engagement Achieved Results Amendment Act of 2006. And while it has a lot of things in it and actually shifts the focus on the causes of crime being a public health crisis and whatnot, a lot of good things in it, it detracts from the fact that we have local issues regarding police. And our organization, Pan-African Community Action, has also joined the campaign to push for the NEAR Act, but there are a couple troubling things in it. One is that it calls for collaboration with the police in terms of identifying the at-risk people that would be set for programs of prevention and whatnot. And so those kind of things, any collaboration with police for us is a red flag because police to us are institutions of us being in control and being colonized in this country. And then to back to your point about the shift, I think when it comes to also Trump coming into power and people's fear of what that means, there's also been an intensification on the national level of the propaganda from the Democratic Party and those in the Republican Party and that ilk who oppose Trump. And it's also not just that they oppose Trump, but it's also, I think, a diversion, a distraction from some of the things that have been put in place in the previous administration where his administration is really just picking up on, like the countries that are banned from people coming in and all those countries were put on a list by the Obama administration, things like that. The immigration, where, of course, the administration prior looked at the DACA support, but then it also was responsible for deporting more people than any other president before then. But, you know, all these different things are not looked at now. And then these mass mobilizations that are in reaction to a fear of Donald Trump are largely controlled by the most soft, I should say, lukewarm of the progressive left and also Democratic Party type supported mobilizations. And so people are getting caught up into that being the leadership of what our response is to the Trump administration and not looking at the more radical, transformative things that had been part of our lexicon prior to that and not really realizing that the people who are just as guilty of crimes against humanity, and even maybe in a more cunning way, are the ones actually leading them in an agenda to oppose Donald Trump. And so it's very interesting that we can see this on the national and on the local level, that we have people that are movements and, you know, are looking at things like this NEAR Act, which has some validity, but also couching it like community control of the police. It was positive that people here started adopting that term and looking at that concept. And our organization has been very instrumental in that. But at the same time, there's still not enough understanding of it, because some of the demands that are in the campaign, in fact, all of the demands that are in the campaign regarding police that are being worked on simultaneously with the NEAR Act should be precluded if you think community control of the police is part of them. But those other things are redundant if we're really looking at and really able to achieve community control of the police, like defunding police and fully funding the NEAR Act, things like that. Well, if we have community control of the police, which includes control of the budget and the funding, then we can fund all the programs that the NEAR Act has. Not only do that, we can actually be in control of them and control of a whole lot more things regarding the police. And so to me, that's a reflection of people not necessarily understanding what community control of the police is. So we start with trying to get people to at least talk about it, but we have yet to achieve a fuller understanding of those things. And right now, like you said, it seems to become harder because people have seemed to become distracted with other things.
So how are you pushing for community control of the police in D.C. and capturing or recapturing the attention?
So what we've been doing since we formed in November 2015, but then really getting momentum in January 2016, is we've been having community popular education sessions all around different aspects of issues with the police, and then showing how community control of the police, those issues will be mitigated. For example, one would be the black-on-black crime issue, or the so-called black-on-black crime issue, which we refer to as intercommunal violence. And so if we have one on that called The Myth of Black-on-Black Crime and Community Control of the Police. And so when we do that, we show how the media and different things create this notion of black-on-black crime. But at the same time, if we had community control of the police, we could create different things that address the symptoms or the components that we identify, that the community identifies as causing this notion of black-on-black crime, like joblessness of people returning citizens, or the type of media that is consumed by our youth, those kind of things. So if the community is empowered, we can organize. Even before we have community control of the police, we have to be organizing in the meantime to get control of our communities, get control of the perception and the hearts and minds of our people, and at the same time build the infrastructure, or the embryonic infrastructure of what would come to be if we had community control of the police. So we've been doing these popular education sessions and also engaging, you know, whenever we had been, but now with the a shift, engaging in the direct actions and speaking about it in different local media. And then one of the components about that that's important is that often the movement that's come out of Ferguson and what's known as the Black Lives Matter movement has focused so heavily on mobilization, it's become necessary for us to make a distinction and understanding of the difference between mobilization and organization. So whenever we're talking, we are making that distinction and saying how we need to shift more to a more protracted, permanent type of thing, transformative, including the community, that kind of thing. And people are picking that up. And so actually people are talking about these things. And I think that we want to be able to take whatever credit we have in terms of making that shift. And not that's not all credit, because some of the organizations here are very admirable, but some of them are still very conscious, politically conscious, too. It's like having us understand that we have to organize projects and things that involve the most impacted in our community. And then actually we started talking about things like organizing a childcare cooperatives and things that the community needs to help realize that we can't wait for the powers that be, for the state, to give us some of these things that exacerbate our conditions, but we can actually organize and create them ourselves. And we don't need to wait until we have control of the budget and other democratic institutions, but we can actually start without sanction of the government.
There are various formulas that have been put forward for community control of police. Which formula are you proposing for Washington, D.C., and how is your formula a democratic one, one that really reflects democratic values?
Well, because Washington, D.C. is like a colony within a colony in terms of not having state power, state legitimacy, we have to get a bill, an initiative. The form of community control of police will be by ward. Here, Washington, D.C. is broken up into wards, and we feel like if we're proposing that each ward and every ward should agree on this, even if you're in some affluent white community, which already mostly has community control over their police, you still shouldn't have any problems with other people having community control over their police. So if we were to be able to pass something where the citizens of a particular ward can reside on a rotating control board that sets policies by the police, what form that they want by ward, allocates the monies, various monies that the police budget has, all based on the mandates that come from community assemblies, where communities would come together and address certain components of it and make decisions on how these things should be managed. And then a community control board, a randomly selected rotating board, and we say randomly selected, meaning like they would be chosen from a lottery, much like a jury duty. And we say that's important because elected officials are prone to be co-opted. They're prone to be financed and supported by a dubious means, and they're prone to also be pulled from more preferable classes of people. So a randomly selected board and a lottery would allow people who are most impacted by the police to serve on the board and have a say on what's happening, even those who are most adversely impacted. And so that's the loose sketch of how that would work for us. And here in Washington, D.C., we have to first have to win an initiative, and that means to get enough signatures and all that stuff on the ballot through a petition process, and then draft a bill to get approved by the Board of Elections and Ethics. And then after that, unfortunately, because everything has to go through approval of the U.S. Congress, the U.S. Congress will have to approve whatever we come up with. But that's the battle that we can't shy away from. Just because that they're going to approve it doesn't mean it shouldn't be something that's pursued. And by the time we raise the campaign and do enough work that the community has buy-in, we would hope that they would be ready to stand up against any opposition that the Congress would level against us.
And under this formula, we wouldn't be talking about asking the state or the federal government to defund some aid to police that misbehave, because the community would be setting the budget year to year for the police.
Exactly. We'd be setting the budget. We'd be choosing things. We would probably devise a process where we could choose the police chief, because right now the police chief obviously is appointed by the mayor and approved by the city council. And I don't think it's unheard of for communities to be able to have some sort of elected official that presides over all of the police. And so right now, people are upset because we just had a new police chief appointed by Mayor Bowser, and people are upset. But I think this reflects maybe a lack of understanding of community control of police on the local level, because if we had that and we fight for this, we don't want to respond and just reject whoever they appoint. We actually want to have a say on who the nominees are, who's up for selection, who gets finally approved. By the same token, if we were successful in doing it, then he'd only be replaced by somebody else who would be an agent of the state. And so we have to really understand that when we're talking about the police, we're talking about, until we have community control of the police, we're talking about an occupying force that can only facilitate control of us to support the capitalist system. And one thing that we have to look at, and I think it's important for us to look at this nationally, the Movement for Black Lives has a vision statement, a platform that calls for community control on a lot of aspects. And one of them, obviously, is also community control of the police. And so in order to get this, and it's a tall order, but it's something that needs to be fought for, obviously, on the local and community levels. But to do so, the community must be organized. If we're going to have mass assemblies, community assemblies that make decisions and involve people, that means those things that involve organizing the community. And so when we organize the community, we've created unstoppable force, but it's just not easy. And so we can't depend only on mobilizations and handfuls of people demanding things from the powers that be, but and the whole involvement and buy-in that there's an infrastructure for and that's permanent, that shifts power into the hands of the community and doesn't merely exercise the nominal form of power to make those in power do what we want them to do.
You appear to be saying that the black liberationist segment of the movement isn't setting the tone or the agenda. But in terms of that movement, some of the most prominent organizations get their sustenance in terms of their funding, certainly from outside the community.
Right. What's interesting is that a lot of the younger people have adopted and accepted the concept, the nonprofit industrial complex. And we used to hear it even before the movement of Black Lives was that people were concerned about the influence and the hamstrings that being the nonprofit industrial complex or the NGO community or sector puts on us in terms of making transformative social transformations. And we saw early on when the movement for Black Lives started where certain foundations, Soros Ford Foundation, was offering big money. And we know, we've seen this in the past, where even during the 60s, when they offered Dr. King and Whitney Young and all these people lots of money. And so here we're seeing the same thing. Lots of money is being pumped into organizations and using their 501c3 status. Of course, we need the money. But at the same time, it makes things less radical, waters down. People end up doing tailoring things so that they're acceptable for the status quo. And we have to remember that a lot of the organizations and a lot of the movement was proposing, asserting being anti-capitalist. And so we're saying we're anti-capitalist. And so intellectually, that's an accepted thing. But then what's not as equally accepted or understood is a nonprofit industrial complex is just that. It's an industrial complex, which means it's an integral part of the capitalist system. And so if we're trying to get rid of capitalism and replace it with a different system and socially transform society, that's going to be one of the things. So we have to find a way to support our movements. And when we build membership and we're membership organizations and we're asking people to support the organizations with their hard-earned money, even if it's not a lot of money, $10 a month or something like that. Imagine if we had a mass organization and so many people like just paying $10 a month or $10 a year even, you can actually have a budget that's millions of dollars or hundreds of thousands of dollars yearly to support you. But often people are going for the quick money, big sums of money from a wealthy institution or individual, which then leaves them beholden to that. And we can see, and I think it's no mistake, that if we look at even some of the conversations and we look at some of the foundations like the Ford Foundation, a lot of the movement, a lot of the organizations in the United Front of the Movement for Black Lives are listed as grantees from these organizations. So we just have to remember that this is a problem and that we have to eventually find a way to address. It doesn't take away, it's not a character judgment on the people who are involved in this. There's probably lots of good intentions. I know that there's good intentions among some of the people, but we have to do a better job of finding a way to be truly financially, economically independent, because if we don't do that, then they can cut us off at the knees whenever we're gaining any serious momentum about shifting power to our people.
That was Nepha Freeman of Pan-African Community Action in Washington, D.C.
The Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations is engaged in two main projects. One is an upcoming two-day electoral politics school to be held April 8th and 9th in St. Petersburg, Florida. The other is the coalition's commitment to Black community control of the police, a key item in the coalition's 19-point National Black Agenda for Self-Determination, adopted last year. In Philadelphia, Black is Back Coalition organizer Diop Olugbala says the two issues are intertwined.
The Black is Back Coalition in April of 2015 held a national conference on Black community control of the police in Ferguson, Missouri. And as we know, in 2014 was the murder of Mike Brown by the Ferguson police. And that unleashed a whole new period of resistance amongst the African population in this country, particularly young African workers. So although the coalition has, since its inception, put forth the demand for Black community control of the police, the resistance that has occurred subsequent to Mike Brown's murder has allowed for the demand to be heard in an entirely different way. And here we are now in 2017, and we are pushing forth with the demand for Black community control of the police, recognizing that it's not enough to demand body cameras on the police or to shout empty slogans that make no real demands of transformation in the relationship that our people have with the police in this country. So Black Community Control of Police is the only way forward. And one of the mandated activities that came out of the conference in Ferguson was to begin to struggle or to push for local city council to adopt the Black Community Control of Police resolution that would specifically require or call for the right for the Black community itself to have democratic authority over the police force in our community, including the right to hire, fire, as well as set training standards of police in our community, and most importantly, subpoena power to bring the cops that violate the rights of our people to justice. So we have struggled to meet the objectives that have been laid out in that conference, and much of our work in Philly has revolved around that. And on Thursday, February 16th, myself, along with other comrades of the Black Community Control of Police Working Group in Philly, we attended the local city council meeting to put forth the resolution and demand its adoption by city council. And that process, in many ways, was significant. For the first time, in fact, the city council was forced to really address the question of power in the hands of the people around the police question. And we didn't get any real unity from city council representatives. In fact, the president of city council, Darrell Clark, said outright in a subsequent meeting that he does not support the demand for Black community control of the police, and he would be of no assistance in terms of getting the resolution adopted or passed. But that's not a surprise given the track record of Clark and city council and the city of Philadelphia government in terms of just unlimited, unending police terror and repression against our community. So we're not surprised. At the same time, we recognize that the real struggle is not in the city council chambers. It's in the streets. It's in the community. The real task is to win the masses of our people to embrace the demand for Black community control of police, and to be clear that there's nothing that we should not be willing to do to protect and defend our communities.
It looks like you want to put Black community control of the police in a popular court of opinion, as opposed to just letting the city council handle it.
That is the goal. All of our work really revolves around some of the other demands or objectives of the campaign, which includes petition work, as well as a distribution of the Know Your Rights card that came out of the 2015 conference as well. So we have assembled a street team. We go out in the community and distribute these materials and get the people to sign a petition, because that is a demonstration of popular support that we are gaining for the demands for Black community control of the police. And it's going to be a hot summer, and we plan to be out here to make it as hot as possible and to deepen the struggle to its final conclusion.
Black is Back Coalition's also holding next month, April 8th and 9th, an electoral school to discuss and get into the nuts and bolts of electing Black folks who will actually serve the Black community. You live in Philadelphia. Philadelphia is at least 40% Black. It's had a bunch of Black mayors, and a large percentage of its police force is Black. But that has not solved the problem of a predatory police force.
You're absolutely right on both counts. Firstly, yes, on April 8th and 9th, the coalition will be holding a school to train grassroots organizers and concerned members of the Black community on how to effectively run an electoral campaign, not only for candidates who wish to change the conditions in our community by running for public office, but we are also opening up the question of referendums and initiatives that would actually give the people the ability to vote for laws such as reparations and Black community control of the police in our respective cities. So the school that's going to be happening in St. Petersburg, Florida, April 8th and 9th, is not only going to train people how to run for office, but also how to effectively run a campaign to raise up strategic referendums and initiatives.
So you're considering the possibility of submitting Black community control of the police to referendum in Philadelphia?
Absolutely. In fact, we are already constructing a Black community control of police charter, which would kind of serve as the framework for such a referendum that would raise up the most significant issues that revolve around the police question. Right now, for example, you have a Philadelphia jail system that is filled with black bodies, and most of whom were sent to jail under the prosecutorial jurisdiction of the district attorney named Seth Williams. However, it was recently also exposed that Seth Williams has been taking tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars in gifts and bribes from other court officials, including defense attorneys and others. And this in itself reveals a clear conflict of interest in terms of the way prosecution is handled in the city of Philadelphia. And what we are saying is that if Crook is the one responsible for running the prosecution process, then how in the hell could those who have been convicted be seen as criminal? All those cases need to be thrown out, and we demand the immediate release of all black people who have been jailed as a consequence of Seth Williams' office prosecution. There's also this question of stop and frisk, which the state has been able to elude in many ways, but the reality is that stop and frisk is alive and well. And even in the year 2014, the same year that Mike Brown was murdered, you had over 250,000 stops, 3 out of 4 of them of black people. And we include Latinos in that category. And Seth Williams, when he ran for DA, made a specific promise to open up a prosecution office in every so-called high crime neighborhood in the city. So we see that the entire Philadelphia court and prison system is fueled by profit, interest of money, as opposed to keeping the community safe and protecting the interests of the black community itself. You also have a situation where a judge out of Reading, Pennsylvania, named Mark Ciavarella, was recently convicted and sentenced 28 years for selling, literally selling, convictions of young juvenile offenders to the private juvenile detention centers or private youth jails. And he was actually convicted and sentenced for 28 years. So, again, the question of any African youth, and that's the majority of who we see locked up in these youth, so-called juvenile detention centers, the question of their cases need to be opened up as well. We're saying they all need to be released. It's not enough just to lock the judge up. But we're saying let these young Africans who have been wrongly prosecuted and convicted and jailed immediately, they need to be set free. And lastly, there's the issue of the economic extraction of the black community. There was in place a policy that parents of the youth who were being jailed are responsible for paying for the fees to house or to sustain the prisoners. They actually have to pay tuition. And this policy was recently overturned after a series of struggles that were happening inside the court system. So now parents no longer have to pay the child support to the youth prison system. But what about all these thousands and hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, that black families have had to pay to the state prior to the overturning of this policy? So these are some very glaring examples of how the police, prison, and court system in the city of Philadelphia and the state of Pennsylvania is designed to extract wealth from the black community and has no regard for even seeking any kind of objective process to determine who is really a criminal or not.
Black is Back Coalition organizer Diop Olugbala speaking from Philadelphia.
Prison reform and prison abolitionist groups across the country are gearing up for a Millions for Prisoners Human Rights March set for August 19th in Washington. Pastor Kenneth Glasgow is founder of the Ordinary People Society, comprised of formerly incarcerated persons. He's also an outside spokesperson for the Free Alabama Movement, which is run by prison inmates themselves. One of the Free Alabama Movement's key organizers is Kinetic Justice, also known as Robert Earl Council, a prisoner who was recently singled out for retaliation by Alabama prison authorities. Pastor Glasgow explains.
What's happening with Kinetic Justice is he has stomach problems. We have problem with our small intestines having blockages and all that. And we have tried to do some kind of study and research on what's going on with some of us, and come to find out that nobody could tell us, even the producers of that mystery meat, they can't tell us what it is. And this is what's really, really bothering Kinetic. He has told them for the past 2 to 3 years that he needs some kind of medical attention due to the fact that his stomach, there's some blockage going on, he can't use the bathroom properly, and so on and so forth. And they're not giving him the proper medical attention that he needs. That's first and foremost. The second thing that we must look at with Kinetic Justice is they moved him from out of general population and they put him at Limestone. Limestone is a place where they got him very well secluded. They used to have a place in Limestone where it was called the Dog Pound. The Dog Pound housed inmates that have HIV who are HIV positive. Housed them there. In the housing of them there, they got a lawsuit declared and decreed that they were violating their civil rights, their constitutional rights, by keeping them away from general population. And so they had the dispel of housing HIV inmates in the what's called the Dog Pound. The Dog Pound is very, very secluded away from general population at Limestone Prison and off to an area like almost an island by itself. You can't even see over there what's going on in the general population. There's 3 dorms where they keep people that's totally seclusive to itself. This is what they've been using ever since they had to take the HIV inmates out. They have been using it to seclude people who they declare leaders of the Free Alabama Movement, who they declare problems, or people that they declare overthrow administration, or people that they declare are better, for lack of better words, people that they declare unmanageable, that they can't control or contain. People that have influence in the prisons and all that, which Kinetic Justice, Robert Earl Council, would fall into that category because of his influence and his leadership in Free Alabama Movement. So they put him over there, and they've been housing him there in that solitary confinement cell. And one day they took him out, had him handcuffed in shackles, 2 officers. They pushed him in what was like a closet, storage room type deal over there, and they proceeded to beat him while he was in handcuffs and shackles. Now, let me remind you, once they beat somebody, they always come back with a verdict, oh, he tried to attack an officer. Now, I just want everybody to use their common sense. If you have a person that is in handcuffs and shackles, do you think that they would really try? How could they, first of all, attack you while they're in handcuffs and shackles? They're already restrained. And second of all, do you think that they would really do that in the right mind? In the right mind frame, who would do that and know that they messed up? So the thing what gets me is whenever they do that to somebody, they turn around and say, oh, he attacked the officer. This is what happened with Robert Earl Council, a.k.a. Kinetic Justice. They beat him up pretty bad. He was able to get somebody in there, was able to get the word out to some of us that they had beat him up. So we went and did, on the 18th, we went and did a march and a protest in front of Limestone for Kinetic Justice and for his safety and his health. Since then, they have moved a lot of the different people that was over there that have been there previously. They moved them back to their general population prison, but yet and still, Robert Earl Council, Kinetic Justice is still remaining there. But we are asking people to lift up their prayers. His mother was out there with us, his brother, his sister-in-law, and his father, Robert Earl Council Sr., was out there with us when we did the protesting in front of Limestone.
So Kinetic Justice is suffering from legal and physical retaliation because of his politics, in addition to suffering from the endemic health conditions that exist in the prison. You know, back in slavery time, at least some masters did have some concerns about the health of their slaves because, well, they had a real investment in them. One of the, if not the primary point of the Free Alabama Movement and the larger prison movement is to designate and abolish the condition of slavery that U.S. mass incarceration represents.
Exactly. And we declared when we went up there and marched with Sharpton, on the 14th of January, we declared a boycott against Aramark. Aramark is one of the leading food distributors across the country when it comes to prison food. And I think about 32 different states, but also Aramark is one of the biggest distributors when it comes to college food that's in colleges and also in stadiums. Football stadiums, baseball stadiums, basketball stadiums, and all. Aramark has a tendency. Detroit went ahead and dismissed them because of the fact they had maggots in their food. North Carolina, the same thing. Alabama and different states had complaints on them because of their lack of nourishment in the food and all. In Virginia, they had rocks in their food, which was really knocking out teeth of inmates and all. So, you know, Aramark is one of the big things we also are starting to look at and declare a boycott against Corizon, C-O-R-I-Z-O-N. Corizon has been one of the biggest medical distributors. And Corizon has been doing that in their lack thereof, I should say. And that's one of the biggest contributors towards some of the demise that's going on with people's health that's getting out of prison. Now, you mentioned slavery and you mentioned the fact that some masters would take care of their slaves because they had an investment in them. Well, that's not so the truth with those who are currently incarcerated because they feel like they have no investment in them. They'll just replace them with somebody else. But this is surely slavery, but it's in its worst condition. And that, what you have pointed out, declares and shows one of the worst conditions about it is that they won't even invest in the health. We have people, God, Charles Johnson was here with us last week on my radio show, and he was explaining to us about his brother. And his brother went in with diabetes, simple diabetes, where he'd take a pill and he'd take his insulin shot, and that's it. Who died because his body became stiff, his body became numb, and his body became paralyzed because they wouldn't even give him his insulin. And he just had mere diabetes. You know, it wasn't even a severe case of diabetes. He was on pills. Wasn't even on insulin. And so these are the type of things that's going on there. We tried to do some geriatric bills in different states in the South to try to get some relief for those that had strokes, those that were old and elderly, those that had health conditions that they couldn't really be a threat to society in any kind of way, form, or fashion, and they still wouldn't let them out. You know, I don't know. They had no kind of investment or divestment in keeping them there, but they did. And they just use them for free labor. That's all they are used for is free labor, no matter what medical conditions are, how well they could do any kind of work or anything, their capacity whatsoever. What we have in this new modern-day slavery is a master who don't care about the slave, who don't care what their condition is, who don't care about keeping them medically healthy and all that, who don't care whether they produce as much as they want, but just as long as they can produce, period, who only cares about the numbers because they're getting paid by the numbers and the bodies that exist and not so much as the work that's being produced. You know, it's like twofold with them. So we got to be very, very careful in our comparison of saying slavery then in old days compared to slavery now, because now it's much more different. I, for one, my brother, believe that the Constitution contradicts itself. And this is why we're marching and going to Washington on August 19th, all of us collectively. We preparing as the formerly incarcerated and convicted people's movement, the FICPFM, the formerly incarcerated and convicted people's movement have been, you know, organizing this way before now. Years and years we have been organizing it, but this group, Millions for Prisoners, came up and said, no, y'all keep organizing. We finna do it. So we had to come in and join in with them, and we thank them for their initiative and what they're doing and going forth with this work. We had one of our group, Andrea James, and she heard the March for the Women last year. She was going to do the first one, then we come right behind it. We spoke at the Millions Man's March last year and told them that we will be marching on Washington, but then, as I said, this group said, come on, man, we finna move. And they moved, and they start organizing. They start preparing and mobilizing folks all across the country. And what all of us collectively are coming together for, to march on Washington, is because we see that slavery still exists, and it's even worse than it ever was. Now, let me get back and show you how the Constitution contradicts itself. In our Constitution, we have the Eighth Amendment that says no cruel and unusual punishment. Am I correct?
Yes, it's in there.
In the 13th Amendment, it turns around and says that no man could be held under involuntary servitude or slavery except or by for felony conviction as a means of punishment. Now, what is more cruel and unusual punishment than slavery? So here's where the Constitution totally contradicts itself. You can't say in one spot in the 13th Amendment that you could be held enslaved or involuntary servitude as a means of punishment. But then in the 8th Amendment, you said that, no, you can't have cruel and unusual punishment, but you have slavery, which is the most cruel and unusual punishment that ever existed and that ever can be. And even now, it's even more cruel and unusual because now they won't even spend money to keep healthy their slaves that they have because they have no investment.
A group of inmates in Aurora, Colorado, inmates in an immigration detention facility, recently won the right to pursue a class action suit charging that they are being held in slavery because they're forced, they say, to work for $1 an hour. And the judge agreed that they could sue as a class, and that might involve tens of thousands of them. Do you think this might set a precedent for federal and state criminal prisoners?
Not only do I think it sets a precedent, but it speaks exactly to the fact of what we're marching for on August 19th, 2017, what our march on Washington is about. I mean, this is exactly what the Free Alabama movement last year did a May Day about. In January, did a national prison strike that went all across the country, 24 different states, 40 to 50 different prisons. This is exactly what they did with the Free Alabama movement, who are told the group of inside, people inside that organized, mobilized, initiated, and created the national prison strike that you just seen took place again. So they have definitely set a precedent because we have to look at, there's been more national prison strikes going on than ever. Let me tell you, at first you had the prison strike with Georgia. That was in December 9th, 2012, which went across 10 different prisons in the state of Georgia. I was the spokesperson for them. Then you turned around and had it initiated, and it inspired those in California to have a homeless strike. It initiated and inspired those in the Free Alabama movement to have a shutdown strike or a non-workage, peaceful non-workage strike. And that strike took place the first time. It only hit maybe Alabama, Georgia, and maybe a couple of prisons in Florida. This time they had it this year, and it hit 24 different states, 40 to 50 different prisons. Okay? So we launched it on September 9th because it was the 45th anniversary of Attica. What they have done in Colorado is not only set a precedent, my brother, but they have proven the fact of what's been being said since 2010 on by different people that are currently incarcerated, by those of us who are formerly incarcerated, that this is slavery. You cannot make it look like, disguise it, paint it up to be, curtail it, or make it anything other than what it is. It's slavery. And it's slavery by another name. Whoever came up with that name was great. And we also want to give props to Ava that came out with the 13th. But in the 13th, my only critique would be she didn't come with no resolution. We all pointed out the problem. But what is the resolution? And that resolution was given by the Free Alabama Movement. That resolution was given by those in South Carolina prisons, Brother SJ and all of them. And that resolution was, if you want to really look at the overcrowding, then look at the Habitual Offender Act in our different states. Look at your life without parole laws in our different states. Look at your Innocence Inquiry Commission that only pertain to those inmates on death row and should extend to anybody to be innocent. You know, just because a person is not on death row, does that mean that there shouldn't be an inquiry on whether they're innocent or not? Look at how we adjudicate juveniles as adults. That's a contributing factor as well. And when we look at all these things in these different states, States, we also got to look at the labor that's going on that is slavery without getting paid. Now, we have to look at that the public out there is saying, oh, these are people that are criminals. They locked up. They're in prison for doing wrong. Yeah, but guess what? They are also contributing to your unemployment. Taxpayers should be mad as hell right now on what's going on, because the media have convinced us and tried to portray to us that all these jobs, the reason that we have unemployment is because they've been outsourcing to other countries. They haven't been outsourcing Black Agenda. They have been insourcing, and insourcing with my brothers, your brothers, our fathers, our nephews, our nieces, our mothers, and sisters right there in prison. We have young ladies that got locked up because they came forth the media and told them, all you women that's buying Victoria's Secret, we're the ones that stamp on your panties made in China, and they made right here in prison. You know, you can look on the Alabama Department of Corrections website, and you can see the different prisons where they're producing different things. You can look on any state prison website and see where the different prisons are producing different things. Let me give you an example. Holman Prison in Alabama produces a $1.7 million industry in just license plates for tags for cars alone. $1.7 million. They have to produce 20,000 tags a day in order to keep up with their production of 100,000 tags a week. Now, let me show you where slavery. If you do not go to work, you get a disciplinary, locked up in solitary confinement. If you got any kind of extra days or given days or earned credit days or whatever towards your sentence, that's taken away from you. Good days, they call them.
So there is no question that this is not voluntary labor.
Oh, no, there's no question about that. In Alabama, not only is there no question about it, in Alabama, a lot of people don't even know there's no such thing as a grievance procedure. At least in Georgia and other prisons, you got a grievance procedure, whether they adhere to it or not. In Alabama, you don't even have a grievance procedure. I won two lawsuits in Georgia because of the way that they were treating their SMU, special management unit inmates, not giving them a chance to take showers and bathe, not giving them proper commissary, not giving them visitation. Look it up. I won that lawsuit in Georgia back in 2012. So we got to look at here in Alabama, we won several lawsuits, changed plenty of laws. You know, even different organizations got lawsuits now about the medical attention and all. But to sit up here and ask whether it's forced labor and is it slavery, it definitely is. By all means and by all facts that prove it.
And if you think Pastor Kenneth Glasgow sounds a lot like Reverend Al Sharpton, you're right. He's Sharpton's half-brother.
On April 3rd, peace activists will gather at the New York University School of Law for a discussion to mark the 100th anniversary of the U.S. entrance into World War I, which was supposed to be the war to end all wars. It's also the day before the 50th anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s historic speech at New York's Riverside Church, in which he broke with President Lyndon Johnson over the Vietnam War. We spoke with David Swanson, the author and activist who publishes the influential website War is a Crime. He's one of the organizers of the April 3rd event at New York University. Half a century after Dr. King's Riverside speech, it seems that even discussion of peace is considered politically suspect.
I think that's exactly right. You know, a lot of people remember April 4th. 68, Martin Luther King was killed. A small number of people remember April 4th, 67. He gave that speech against war in Vietnam and against war in its entirety after having been urged not to by so many well-meaning advocates for civil rights that wanted him to stay in his lane and stick to his issue. And a very, very tiny number of people remember that 50 years earlier, so 100 years ago, this April 4th, the United States Senate voted to enter a war that was going to end all wars and got the United States into this
habit of war making with World War One. But here we are in a day and age when war has become this monstrosity that I don't think Dr. King even imagined. I don't think Eisenhower in his military-industrial complex speech even fantasized what it's now become. And as we speak, I've just been looking through all these statements from different organizations and leaders and Congress members about Trump's budget proposal. And I can read these lengthy statements from Richard Trumka, a top labor leader from the Sierra Club, or a top environmental group, from 100 Christian faith leaders that denounce all these cuts to all these wonderful things and never mention the existence of the U.S. military. So, you know, Donald Trump knows to expect his opposition to be even dumber than he is. And as long as he moves all the money out of everything good and useful and decent, but puts it in the military, people will tie one hand behind their back and just go on droning on, no cuts, no cuts, and everybody hearing big government, and, you know, and never get to the conversation that Dr. King said we should have over what kind of government. If we're spending more on military, he said, than on social uplift, we're approaching spiritual death. Well, you know, we long since passed spiritual death. You know, we're somewhere among the living dead now.
War seems to be a normal state in the United States that is only remarkable if it reaches a situation in which lots of Americans get killed.
I think that's right. You have now a madman having been handed the most expensive military ever to have existed in the world, the most widespread, the most bases, the most ships and troops and so-called special forces and robot airplanes everywhere, advocating killing families and stealing oil, putting armed drones on the border of North Korea and proposing to start an aggressive war against North Korea, all sorts of other madness, including more nuclear weapons, more so-called usable nuclear weapons, massive investment in things like the F-35 that he campaigned against. And we have just accepted that this is the way it's going to be. So you now are going to see 60-65% of what Congress spends money on every year going into militarism, if they can get this thing through somehow, if they can wrangle 60 senators. But there's not an opposition in the corporate U.S. media, in the Congress. There's no existence of the military or war mentioned by the Women's March or the Scientists' March. We launched a huge campaign of public pressure to get the People's Climate March, you know, which claimed to be for everything, you know, this long laundry list of labor rights, gay rights, et cetera, to get them to mention any sort of preference for peace over war. You know, it took a massive public campaign. So we have to face the sort of pressure in a different way, and in some senses a larger way, that Dr. King faced in saying, I'm not going to remain silent any longer. I'm going to speak against this madness. No matter how many people are sharing in it, it is madness. And to not speak against it would be a betrayal.
It's been, I believe, 72 years since the United States was engaged in a declared war. But in that period of time, the U.S. has been responsible for the deaths of many millions of people.
That is absolutely right. Probably tens of millions, certainly over 2 million just in recent wars, and many millions more as a result of the choices of where to invest. You know, it would take a teeny fraction of military spending to end starvation on Earth, to end the lack of clean drinking water, to end various diseases, to support sustainable agriculture, et cetera. So, you know, the vast amount of the killing is a choice of where to put resources. And then you look at the weapons and the environmental damage, and the U.S. military as our biggest destroyer of the climate and the waters and the earth. And the destruction is absolutely incredible. And the very idea that Congress has the power, or that the people should have the power to decide on war, or that war should be only defensive, is almost forgotten. You know, just before World War II, the Ludlow Amendment that would have required a public referendum before Congress could launch a war was defeated under pressure from President Roosevelt. You then had the United States get into the worst thing the human species has ever done to itself in World War II and never ended. You know, it has never ended the Korean War, and the troops have never come back from Japan or Germany. They've just expanded to other places. The taxes have never gone away. The military machinery has never gone away. Our rights have never been restored, and it just rolls on and on. And I have Democratic partisans announcing to me this week as a result of a Wall Street Journal article that the war powers have been taken away from Congress and the president, as if the president had them, and given to the CIA by Donald Trump, and this is some new constitutional catastrophe. And if that sort of thinking gets people to oppose drone murders now, finally, then I'm all for it. But even in the era of George W. Bush, we were down to sort of these vestiges of bothering to lie to Congress and getting these vague authorizations. In the Obama era, I mean, he went out of his way to launch wars like the one on Libya, making clear that Congress had no role whatsoever in launching all of these drone wars in numerous nations. And even those reporters claiming that Obama took the power to make certain decisions away from the CIA and put it in the Pentagon on these drone operations, which involve the CIA and the Pentagon and the Air Force and the NSA, they're not denying that Obama created that power for the CIA in the first place. They're just claiming that he limited it and Trump is unlimiting it. But if Trump's face on U.S. wars and U.S. bases helps resistance to them, I'm all for it. But yeah, let's be clear. There has not been a respect for the Constitution in this sense for over 70 years.
And on April 3rd in New York, you'll be part of an event that remembers past wars and is aimed at preventing the next war.
I will, and you will, I certainly hope. We're going to be at NYU, at the NYU School of Law, Vanderbilt Hall, 6 o'clock to 9 o'clock on April 3rd, so the evening before the April 4th anniversary. And Joanne Sheehan is going to be with us, the coordinator of the War Resisters League. Alice Slater, the New York director of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation. Deborah Karpatkin, who is co-general counsel of the New York Civil Liberties Union. Maria Santelli, who's the director of the Center on Conscience and War. And hopefully all sorts of great people. It's an open and free event in New York City on April 3rd. People can find it at worldbeyondwar.org. And I'm very much looking forward to it. I don't think we should let things like 100 years since World War I and 50 years since Dr. King spoke the truth to power pass by unrecognized while we have holidays for every crazy war memorial imaginable.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.